You're listening to the Newsmakers podcast from MLB.com.
This is the Rocket, Bill Latson. Welcome to Newsmakers. Baseball had its share of news last week, the passing of Mike Ilitch and Jeffrey Loria possibly selling the Marlins. I spoke to Jason Beck about Mike Ilitch and Justice about the Marlins. Enjoy the podcast. I have one of the best reporters at MLB.com. He's been there almost 20 years now, and he covers the Detroit Tigers, and his name is Jason Beck. I asked Jason to come to the show because of Mike Ilitch. And Jason, thank you so much for being with me.
Thanks for having me on. I've been looking forward to doing this podcast for a while now. It's great to be able to talk baseball with you.
Yeah. You have covered the Tigers for a long time, and I'd like to know, what kind of person was Mike Ilitch?
You know, it was tough to say that from a media standpoint, because he was, from our vantage point, he was kind of a private guy. It was easier for players to get to know him, I think, than us. A lot of what we saw was kind of limited to the private eye, or you know, to the public eye and to press conferences and stuff. But you know, you kind of get an idea talking with players and coaches and see how he was able to deal with it. He was, I think that the big thing to remember with Mike Ilitch is that he started out as a ball player. He played minor league baseball in Tigers organization in the 1950s. And it wasn't until after, I believe it was a knee injury, did in his career that he started getting into business. And I think he never forgot those roots.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
What you saw from that point on was that he was a really good businessman. He had a great read for the market and how to read what people wanted. But in all that rise up to becoming one of the richest people in the country and certainly one of the richest families in Detroit, he never lost that affinity for Detroit. And I think in the latter years of his life, and I'm not saying like latter 5 to 10 years, I'm talking like latter 20 years, maybe even quarter century, he really invested a lot of time, money, and energy into lifting Detroit up.
And I find amazing about Mike Ilitch is that he owned two franchises, the Red Wings and the Tigers, and almost every year they had a chance to either win the Stanley Cup or a World Series title. How amazing was that to you?
It really was impressive, especially when you consider how different the models are economically between the two sports. But he was able to make it work with really a similar approach. You know, it first took place with the Red Wings, in which he invested in player development. He threw resources into finding good people to run his organization, both in terms of front office and in terms of coaches. And then he invested in players, and he showed an incredible loyalty to guys who won for him. I think I've talked about this over the years with people. You can make parallels to what Steve Eisenman meant for Ilitch's Red Wings. Mm-hmm. You can make parallels to what Ivan Rodriguez meant for Ilitch's Tigers, or what Justin Verlander meant. You know, Verlander might even be a little bit of a better analogy because of the homegrown aspect. I think once he became bound and determined to add a World Series to his mantle, even though it didn't work out, he took aspects of that Red Wings model and threw them into baseball and figured out how to do it. Getting a guy to run the organization from the top down, like Dombrowski, was a huge step in that. But also drafting and developing. A lot of us think of Ilitch's Tigers tenure as spending big on free agents. But before that, there was the investment in player development. Verlander was a big step. Curtis Granderson was a Tigers draft pick under his watch. Mm-hmm. Rick Porcello, you know, they spent big on the draft before the whole, you know, draft pool came into place. And while in Major League Baseball was on him about it, but he knew that that was the way to get the organization out of the doldrums.
That's amazing. You know, a lot of people talk about the two teams that went to the World Series. And, you know, in my opinion, on paper, I thought they were better than the Giants and the Cardinals. I mean, can you tell me why those teams weren't able to go all the way?
There were different reasons in both cases. I think in the case of 2006, a lot of people make a big deal out of the pitching errors. You know, the fielding errors really came back to bite. I think, you know, that offense wasn't really ready for that type of spotlight. You had a little bit of a more seasoned Cardinals team in that World Series, even though they had a way lower win total than the Tigers that year. Whereas, you know, the Tigers were such a sudden success story. When you look at those teams, really, the one guy who's playoff tested, I think, was Pudge Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. Maglio had a little bit of a postseason history, but it was very limited. He was a veteran, but not necessarily a postseason veteran. Carlos Guillen had been in the postseason, but he hadn't been in the World Series before. So I think there's a little bit of an experience factor there. I think when you look at 2012, the problem with that team is a little bit similar to some of the teams in that era where they won those four straight division titles. They had a tremendous offense all of those years, but it wasn't necessarily an offense made for the postseason. It wasn't a diverse offense. These offenses, by and large, are made to pound the ball, to hit for power, really to overpower pitchers. Right. And what happened in the postseason, you know, maybe even more so in other years than 2012, but I think it showed up in 2012 as well, was that when you run in the tough pitching, you've got to find different ways to score runs. And I think common trait among those teams, and they tried to adjust for it in later years in 13 and 14, was that it was tough for them to manufacture offense when they couldn't pound a pitcher. And when you had teams that not only had good starting rotations, but also didn't have weak links in the bullpens to exploit. So I think the memories of 2012 would be, you know, the base running blunders about the losing close, well-pitched games. Now, the Tigers actually pitched pretty darn well that postseason. And it pitched great in the postseason after them, but they couldn't get that extra run across. They couldn't figure out how to get guys on base, move them along without the big hits, and get them in. And I think that's something where, as generously as they spent and as heavily as they invested in offense, they invested in a lot of similar-type hitters and maybe struggled here and there to get those good base runners. They never really found that Curtis Grahamson type that they had in 06. It was tough for them to get that guy.
Wow. And, you know, Mike Ilitch was more than an owner. I mean, there are reports now that he helped Rosa Parks pay her rent. He was more than just an owner. He seemed like he was trying to help people in the community. When you heard that, tell me how you felt.
That didn't surprise me at all. Well, one of the stories I remember, and I've heard it from multiple people, was that there was a Tiger scout, Mike Russell, who he and the family lost their home. I think it was Hurricane Ivan in 2004. They were living along the Florida Panhandle, and they lost everything. And they were looking at a tall task to rebuild. Well, when Mike Ilitch heard his story, he basically made a donation to them to help them get back on their feet. And it was a very generous one at that. And Mike Russell was so touched by that, he tried to repay Ilitch after he got back on his feet. And Ilitch wouldn't accept his money.
Wow.
And eventually what happened was that some people in your organization just said, you know what, instead of trying to pay yields back, try to pay it forward and get to some worthy causes. So what Mike Russell ended up doing was, I think soon after that, he made a donation to the Detroit Tigers Foundation, which was one of Ilitch's charities. And also years later, there's a story of there was a homeless man who was pretty well known around Comerica Park. He was a guy who was cheering outside the ballpark. You could see him in a lot of games outside the gates. Got pretty well known. He died in a hit and run accident. And he really didn't have a big family. He had troubles reaching him, and they were trying to figure out a way to give him the proper burial. Well, Mike Russell made a donation basically to provide him the money to help give him a proper burial. And he didn't want to be well known, but I think when people realized who it was and why he did it, they were so touched that they wanted to get the story out there. I ended up writing about it. And that was a few years ago. So this was, I'd say, almost a decade later. And just, it was that type of impact, I think, that Mike Ilitch made. You know, he wanted to be charitable, but he didn't want to get a ton of recognition for it. But he also wanted to get that spirit going for people to pay it forward rather than paying it.
Wow. You know, he was so popular that I read where the Detroit Lions fans wanted him to own the Lions. And I guess he was that popular.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question again?
Yeah, it seems like he was so popular with the fans that the Detroit Lions fans wanted him to own the Lions and get them back into it winning again.
Oh, yes, very much so. And you know, when the Pistons were up for sale after Bill Davidson died, there was a big sentiment from people who were hoping that he would buy them too. Now, there were some mixed emotions there because it was right around the time that Mike Ilitch and his son Chris were going in on the project to build a new arena in downtown. And I think there were some mixed emotions as far as some Pistons fans really weren't sure if they wanted the team to move back in the city from Auburn Hills. Well, it's ended up happening now with Tom Gores, the current Pistons owner, striking a partnership, and you know, which is kind of another example that Ilitch fostered, is kind of spreading amongst, you know, a lot of people who were able to help in the city of Detroit. But I think you talk to people around baseball and around other sports, and some management types and some other people that, you know, even especially players, there are a lot of people around who wish there were more owners like Ilitch. But I think a lot of those same guys, that it's hard to duplicate a Mike Ilitch. It's difficult to find somebody in that situation where that competitiveness, that desire to win runs so strong that they're willing to invest that type of money, and they're willing to try to win and to try to build a winner.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jason Beck, listen, thank you so much, and I appreciate you coming on to talk about Mike Ilitch, and you take care of yourself.
Thank you. It was great talking about him, and we'll see how the spirit goes on.
I have one of the best baseball writers in America. He's with MLB.com. He's Richard Justice. And Richard, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
And Richard, there's been some news the past few days. Number one, the Brandon Phillips trade. And when I look at that trade, I say to myself, the Braves want to win this year. They're not really rebuilding. What do you think?
I think that's right. And, obviously there's a sadness to this because Sean Rodriguez was the guy that was supposed to play second base for them. Brandon previously had vetoed a trade to the Braves. He'd vetoed three other trades.
Correct.
But Sean was in a car accident, and the Braves don't know when he's going to play. And the Reds have made it clear to Brandon, look, we love you. We love what you mean to our city and our franchise. But we're going to play Jose Peraza when he's healthy this season. It's time to find out. We're going to get younger. And so Brandon decided to go back home to Atlanta. And, Bill, let me just say, he leaves a legacy. And I know there were people that saw Brandon Phillips as a grandstander and a self-promoter and all that stuff. And he had these wars with the media that were silly at times. But I don't know that there was ever a player that represented a franchise better than Brandon Phillips. Every day, autographs. He would get on those buses and go to those caravans in Indiana and Kentucky in the off season. He spent his money on various community projects, baseball diamonds for kids in Cincinnati. And, you know, not only that, you know, he's an older player now, so we don't know what he's got left in the tank. I know it's the last year of his contract. He wants to play a couple more years, and he's always been at his best. He's a fanatical workhorse kind of guy. He's always been his best when people doubt him. And he played the game in Cincinnati with a certain he was an acrobat at second base, an energy. He played with a smile. In a lot of ways, man, you would be hard-pressed to find a player that that checked off all the boxes more than Brandon Phillips. So, you know, it's pretty cool now. You're going to look at Atlanta and see Dansby Swanson's going to be the shortstop, and at least on opening day, Brandon Phillips is going to be the second baseman. Ultimately, the Braves want to bring Ozzie Albies up and let him play, but I think it's an interesting move, and you're right. The Braves are going into a new ballpark, and they want to turn a corner, and they think Brandon can help them do that.
Are you surprised the Reds received so little in return?
No, I think they were the point, and they paid. They're going to pay virtually all of his contract. They were the point where they wanted to play Jose Peraza at second base. He was one of the stars of one of their trades last summer, and they got to find out. This is a chance for them to move forward, and I think ultimately it didn't matter what they got for him. What they got was Jose Peraza to play second base. It would have been awkward to have, you know, I mean, you could play the kid. You can't ask Brandon Phillips to sit on the bench. So they did what they had to do for the long-term health of the franchise. At least that's the way they did.
Brandon Phillips is in his late 30s. How much game does he have left?
Well, that's the question. And his, you can look at the stats many different ways. I think scouts would say he went back a little bit, but his OPS last season was 736. And I had people that saw him every day and said, hey, wait a minute. He was better last season than he'd been for 4 or 5 years. He was really good. He stayed healthy through the year. But he is 35 years old, and there is a point where there's going to be, you know, there'll be a decline in his game. I don't know whether you buy into the stat weighted runs created. He was 10th among National League second basemen last year in that. So I do think he has some game. And I also think, you know, you're going to have to rest him and keep it fresh and all that. All that's probably not, it's going to be easier said than done. He's one of those guys that likes to play every day. But we'll get to find out. And I think the Braves looked at it as his presence is important. The noise he brings, the smile he brings, the pranks he brings, and also he's got enough game, and he's such a fanatic from a from a conditioning standpoint. It's going to be good for the young guys as they bring up, and the Braves expect to have a tidal wave of young guys by the end of the year, to be able to look and say, okay, that's how you have a 15-year career, or, you know, that's how you play 11 years in Cincinnati and go to the All-Star game 3 times and win 3 Gold Gloves. That's how you do it.
And also, the other news was Jeffrey Loria possibly selling the Marlins. How surprised were you to hear this?
Well, I mean, if the reports are the money that he's going to get are, you know, $1.5 billion, over $1 billion, then I can't, you know, ultimately it is a business. He's got I'm not surprised. I hope he's able to stay through the All-Star game in July and have a moment in the sun for the whole country to appreciate what a beautiful ballpark that is. You've been there a lot more than me. And to go from there, it's an interesting legacy. I know he's not real popular in South Florida. A lot of owners aren't. I always found him a guy that he brought a lot of really good baseball people into the organization. I got to know him a little bit, and I think his heart was in the right place. I think he wanted to do the right thing. And I know a lot of baseball people. I mean, I don't mean executives. I mean the scouts and the instructors and all. They really have a high opinion of Jeffrey Loria. So, you know, I think the other thing is, okay, Marlins fans have used this as an excuse not to go to the ballpark. We don't believe in this owner, so we're not going to go to games. Okay, you're going to get a new owner, whoever it is. Are you going to go to the ballpark now? Because they've got a chance to be a pretty darn good baseball team, and certainly with guys like Stanton and Yelich and Echevarria, guys like that, you got a chance to be a pretty exciting team too.
But you know what, Richard? The thing is, though, you can't say Loria didn't try. He did try. I mean,
no question. In
2012, he signed all these free agents. Was able to sign Ozzie Guillen as his manager. He signed Stanton to a long-term deal. I just think he's had some bad luck. I mean, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, and you know, also in that mix of players he had in 2012.
Right.
Bill, what was he supposed to do? It wasn't working. Ozzie Guillen wasn't working. Everything wasn't working. So what are you supposed to do? I remember Jimmy Johnson, the football coach, saying when you make a mistake, you got two choices. You can come in every day and be reminded of your mistake, or you can change courses. And that's what Jeffrey did. You know, and people used it as against him and all of that. But and I think Jeffrey would be the first to tell you that there were days that there were things he did that he would regret a little bit. But, you know, ultimately his legacy in baseball will be that he took an unworkable ballpark in South Florida and he turned it in. He got constructed, however he did it. He got one of the beautiful ballparks in the game constructed, and a ballpark with lots of touches in terms of food and decor and sight lines and all. And that gives the Marlins a chance to succeed going forward.
Are you surprised, as beautiful as Marlins Park is, they haven't really drawn the fans? I'm really surprised.
Bill, I think in places like, you know, I live in Houston, and I think in Sun Belt cities, mm-hmm. Phoenix, Atlanta, Houston, Arlington, Texas, I think you have to win. People have too many other things to do that you have to show you can win. And I think in a place like Miami, this is not quantifiable what I'm going to tell you, but this is my opinion, is that you have to win long-term and run the franchise smartly for people to come out to become ingrained in them. It's not going to be like Detroit where, well, I'm going to go because my grandfather went, you know, Boston, places like that, those Rust Belt towns. It's not going to be that way. The Marlins drew $1.7 million last year, and that was worse in the National League. Now, what I'm telling you is the Rays contradict that completely, in that no team has been run better than the Rays, and yet they've had trouble drawing fans too. So, right. You know, it's a tougher sell in some of those places.
Final question. The Marlins have had some bad luck, unfortunately, with the death of Jose Fernandez. How do they move on?
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about that you know this, you and I have been in a lot of clubhouses.
Right.
Teams are like family, you know? And I was thinking about this with the Royals. You've got to come in. Those guys are going to come in to surprise Arizona, and that locker that Yordano Ventura had is going to be vacant, and that represents a hole in their heart, and you don't fix it. And whatever Ventura was to the Royals, Jose Fernandez was that squared for the Marlins. And not only that, not just the fact that we were looking at potentially one of the great pitchers ever, he was a guy that did amazing work in the community. And in that room, he was the loudest guy. He was the happiest guy. You knew when he walked in that door, he was there. And so it's not just that they liked him. He was a kid. They loved him. And that he was a great pitcher. I think the only way you do it is you just go on. But is it going to be fixed? Is the whole, the hurt you feel for him going to be fixed? I don't think it gets fixed. I think it's like any of us who lose a loved one. You just keep going and do the best you can.
No kidding. You're right about that. Richard Justice, listen, you're the best writer. Listen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Talk again.